It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how realistic are those medical shows on TV? We ask a UW health doctor who consults on some of those programs. First, it's time for our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Primary elections were held in 8 states around the country last night. Mexico is retaliating to U.S. steel and aluminum tariffs by targeting American products. And former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort has been accused of witness tampering. Plus, our question for you this week, what do you think of President Trump canceling a White House visit by the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles, tweeting that there should be no escaping to locker rooms during the national anthem? Did you watch the celebration without the football team? What do you make of this back and forth, this issue for the president and professional football? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Ginger Gibson is a Washington correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with these primaries, Ginger. And a lot of people were looking at California yesterday. Why, first of all, is all this focus on California?
California could be pivotal in deciding who controls the United States House of Representatives next year. And there were a number of races in the state that were being closely watched. There are a handful of Republicans who are either vulnerable or realized they were so vulnerable they left office and retired. And those are seats that Democrats are hoping to pick up. But there was a little bit of a twist. California uses a different system than most states, which sort of gets rid of the partisan primary process and instead puts everybody on one ballot. And had things gone awry, there could have been cases in some of those competitive districts where two Republicans or even two Democrats ended up as the only candidates on the ballot in November. But that didn't happen in any of those competitive House races. And in the gubernatorial race, where Republicans were worried that two Democrats could have ended up pulling out the top two spots and ending up the only options in November.
Right. Each party had a fear here. As you're saying, Democrats were worried, like, hey, we have these competitive races. We might not end up with a Democrat in the final, in part because there were a lot of Democrats. Those statewide races, Republicans were worried about not so much because they have a huge chance at winning the governor or Senate race, but if they didn't have somebody at the top of their ticket come November, Republicans won't be as motivated to turn out and vote for those candidates and the House candidates.
That's correct. I mean, all of this is really like a good problem for Democrats. None of this is like a real problem for Democrats at this point. They were worried that their base is just so enthusiastic that so many people ran and that their base was so enthusiastic they just had too many good House candidates. And that's not something that happened. Republicans, on the other hand, were concerned that without a candidate at the top in the governor's race, they wouldn't be able to get any Republicans to turn out in November. That they would, seeing that there was no option for governor, just decide to stay home. That didn't happen. The Democratic gubernatorial candidate remains the odds-on favorite, but not edging out all Republican opposition at this point.
Now, in California and some other states that had primaries, people play this next day game where they look at, okay, how many people voted for the Democrat in the primaries? How many people voted for the Republican? Can we extrapolate that to November? So can we? Are there lessons to be learned for a runoff based on what we saw yesterday?
It's really bad math to try to add up the number of folks who voted for one party and the other yesterday and think that that means anything for November. For starters, twice as many people, if not more, will vote in November. So having maybe a few thousand more people vote now is not going to be enough to win a race in November. And the electorate that didn't show up yesterday is not identical to the electorate that's going to show up in November. Also, a lot can happen in 5 months. World changes. We can learn more about the candidates, the dynamics, how they run their campaigns is still really important. And that means the numbers can change a lot between now and then. So sure, you could go add the numbers up right now, but probably not the best way to predict the outcome of the November elections.
One more storyline people have been watching through the primaries around the country, a lot of women running for office this year. Did we learn anything yesterday about how they are doing in their primary races?
That is continuing to be one of the biggest takeaways from primary days this spring. Women are winning. They're winning in places where people didn't think they were going to win. There are three states now that may elect a woman governor for the first time. There are women candidates up and down the ballot. And part of that is being pushed by women showing up to the polls and voting for other women. There are Democratic women. There are Republican women. There's just a lot of women getting involved. And I'm told by strategists and political observers that some of this could be the Donald Trump effect. He has so upset so many women. Think of all the women who marched in D.C. after his inauguration. They have not forgotten. They have not gone quietly, and they're showing up this year in these midterm elections.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. I want to move on now, Ginger, to tariffs. The U.S. put these tariffs into place last week on aluminum and steel. Countries including Mexico and Canada, we're hearing from both of our neighbors about this. Here's a bit of what Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had to say.
We have to believe that at some point, common sense will prevail. But we see no sign of that in this action today by the U.S. administration.
And Canada and Mexico are now responding with targeted tariffs at particular products in the United States. And Ginger, there's concern that this could affect election races. This could affect vulnerable Republican candidates in particular. Why is that?
We're seeing Republicans in Congress start to become more vocal in pushing back at the president. And that's because, exactly like you said, voters, particularly in key Republican areas, could be hard hit by these retaliatory tariffs. We're talking about the heartland, places that are decidedly red, places like Wisconsin, where there are competitive House races, where there could be a competitive Senate race, and where dairy farmers and other farmers in the state could be really affected by some of these trade decisions. And for that reason, we do see Republicans in Congress becoming more vocal. We saw Tennessee Senator Corker filing legislation that would block Trump's ability to do this, yet to be seen if he can get a veto-proof majority, but he's got bipartisan support already. And that's because of what these tariffs could mean in real dollars and cents for people in America.
All right, we're seeing Mexico targeting, among many other things, pork products, and there are some potentially tight races in Iowa for Congress that could be affected as Mexico says, hey, we're looking to end tariffs, make it easier to buy pork from other countries, not the United States, not Iowa.
That's right. And, you know, if the price of our bacon goes up at the grocery store, we may not feel it that much. But if you're a pork farmer in Iowa, you're really going to feel it, especially if you're losing access to a market as big as Mexico, one of our biggest trading partners. And for that reason, you're right, places like Iowa, places like Tennessee, where there's an auto market, places like Wisconsin, where there's a dairy market, are really starting to raise alarm bells about this and concern that voters in those states will feel the pain and will respond accordingly.
From pigs to eagles now, Ginger. This week, President Trump canceled this visit to the White House from the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles. Set off more tension in this ongoing conflict with the National Football League over players protesting racial injustice during the national anthem. What do we know? What's the White House saying about the cancellation here?
We have seen this story, this fight that President Trump has decided to engage in with football players continuing on this week. We understand that a group of the Philadelphia Eagles were supposed to be coming to the White House this week, that the Eagles made it known to the White House that it would be a very small group, that some of its players did not want to participate in the event, given that the president has been so critical of NFL football players kneeling during the national anthem. Then the president just said, well, if you're not coming, we cancel, and instead had this what was a quite unusual event at the White House yesterday where they played the national anthem. He gave remarks, and then they sang God Bless America. Not unusual that all of these events would take place at the White House, but you don't often see an event that's just designed to be a show of patriotism that was replacing this Eagles event there.
I want to bring on a caller now on this at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for the program. Thanks for having me on. You know, as a veteran, as I'm watching this, I'm perplexed. It's just hard for me to look at this and say, that these football players that are taking the aren't patriotic. And I think, and you know, I have an issue with the fact that the president is using supposedly their lack of patriotism, you know, as kind of a leverage point against certain voters. And that's how I see it. I think that these people, I think more importantly, what we should be doing is we should be celebrating the fact that we have, these people have the right to protest. We may not agree with it. I decide to stand for the flag, for the playing of the national anthem. I have no problem for someone who decides not to. And, you know, I think it's time for us to kind of broaden our perspective and say that, you know, what really is patriotism? You know, it goes without saying that our country has not always been faithful to our fighting men and women. They've sent them to wars that are more than questionable. They've used them as cannon fodder. They have no problem doing that. But all of a sudden, they're making this an issue of patriotism.
So Paul, I'm going to jump in and bring Ginger in on this. Thanks for that call, Paul. Ginger, President Trump, a lot of people have been reporting, he sees this as a winning issue. This is something he wants to keep bringing up and having in the public eye.
He does. And this whole most recent round of talking about it, like I said, was something voluntarily the president seems to be engaging in. It's a fight he wants to have. He's betting that most voters don't agree with Paul, that they're more likely to agree with him, or that if they do agree with Paul, that they were never going to vote for him or Republicans anyway. This is the kind of issue that he thinks gets his supporters riled up. Midterm elections are about enthusiasm. Rarely do people change their mind and go from Republican to Democrat. It's about who shows up on election day, whether it's more Republicans or more Democrats, in most cases, not all of them, but many of them. And he thinks getting his supporters riled up and excited is one way to get them to turn out to the polls in November.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters about the week's top political news. You can still weigh in on this cancellation of this Super Bowl celebration event replacement with a celebration not so much related to football at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, look at some other issues in national politics coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top news out of Washington. We'll take some more of your calls in a few moments on our question of the week on the cancellation of the Eagles, the Philadelphia Eagles appearance at the White House. Before we go to those calls, though, Ginger, a couple other issues I wanted to get into. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office accusing former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort of witness tampering, saying, hey, get this guy basically back in jail. What's behind these accusations?
That's right. The special investigator Mueller filed with the court saying that Manafort had been in contact with some associates who he was involved with, some type of lobbying. We understand from that filing that they say Manafort told these associates that they should tell the FBI or investigators that all the work they did with Manafort took place in Europe and none of it was happening on American soil, which would be an important question of fact in a trial should he, as that goes forward. They've asked that Manafort be forced to return to jail. They say that that was witness tampering. Manafort's spokesman has insisted that it's not true, that he committed no crime, that there was no criminal offense there. We expect a response in writing from Manafort's legal team on Friday of this week and a hearing before that judge next week. So just when you think things are sort of settling into a groove and they're moving towards trial, this has been another twist in the process.
And this is when a lot of times we see stuff and it's leaked and we're trying to figure out who leaked it and which side leaked it. This was in a legal filing from Mueller. A lot of information was in effect redacted. You're referring to person A and contact B, that sort of thing. But this is information that we actually know and know how we know.
This is correct. This is not a leak. This is not a whisper. This is not, sources said, this is a filing with the court. And we're going to have a hearing before the court likely next week in which some of this will be brought to bear and we'll see lawyers actually arguing with one another. So the fireworks begin, as they say.
And then the Senate recess for August, mostly canceled by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Here he is speaking yesterday.
I think we have enough work to do for the American people. that we should be here during these weeks. I hope we'll get greater cooperation, but everybody should anticipate that we will be here, as I announced today.
So a lot of work to do, Senator McConnell says. Some observers saying, and a lot of Democratic Senate incumbents who would like to be in the district running for office. So what's going on here?
This is what seems like a very political move. Normally, Congress goes home for the entire month of August, as they like to say, to have time to talk to their constituents. Republicans have also often complained that they spend too much time in Washington, and now they're not spending enough time in Washington. We're going to see a lot of messaging around this. Republicans try to beat the drum that Democrats aren't approving the president's appointments, making the case to voters that they need more Republicans in Congress to get President Trump's agenda implemented. And Democrats are going to try to make the argument that Republicans aren't doing anything about health care and that they're sitting there wasting time in Washington while not fixing the nation's health care problems. That's going to be the programming for the month of August. And importantly here, no one's going to be back home campaigning while they're doing that in Washington. And sort of the cynical view, or maybe not that cynical, is that McConnell knows that there's way more vulnerable incumbent Democrats and that keeping them in Washington and away from the campaign trail works to Republicans' benefit.
You tweeted that this may not be a big deal, though, in the end.
That's right. At the end of the day, senators come into Washington most of the time on Monday night or Tuesday morning. They're gone by Thursday night or Friday morning, unless, and they can even tighten that up some. A lot of times the votes they take on Monday night are not particularly important. They're more procedural. They could skip votes if they needed to be at home campaigning, and they have the whole weekend. So it's not like they're chained to their desk in Washington. There's still going to be a good deal of opportunity for them to be on the campaign trail.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Back to your calls, responding to our question of the week about the Philadelphia Eagles not appearing at an event at the White House, canceled by the White House. Jim is with us in Cambridge. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I'm a veteran like your last caller, and I also go to games in Green Bay. My wife has season tickets, and isn't it nice that we look forward to the flyovers? But I got to tell you that the NFL has been taken over by our armed services after 9-1-1, and now it's really a show. And I can say that because I'm a veteran. And I think the president has got it wrong. The players have a right to free speech, and if somebody can get out of jail using the argument of free speech, then why can't the black players have a right to show their displeasure with what's going on nationally?
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I'll move on to Joe now in Janesville. Joe, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I'm just calling to clarify something. The Eagles did not take a knee. Fox fan knows that picture of the long, the two Eagles. One was long, and I don't remember who the other guy was. And that was not during the national anthem. So the Eagles didn't. So it's kind of a moot point that he just using because that's what he wants to rant about.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. And thanks for everybody who responded to our question of the week. Ginger, I want to move on now to a piece that you wrote, the opioid epidemic, big issue in Wisconsin, big issue all over the country. You focused in on a district in upstate New York and how this is playing into a local congressional race there. Can you talk us through that story?
Yes, we looked at the New York 22nd District. It includes the city of Binghamton. It's been very hard hit by the opioid epidemic, outpacing the national rates in deaths and treatments. And they have a competitive congressional race there. And we're finding that voters are really showing up at campaign events and demanding answers. They want something done about this. They're losing more than 100 people a year in this congressional district. More more people than die in auto accidents are dying from opioid overdoses there. And the candidates are responding with different answers. It's not just in New York. This is playing out in races in Indiana, in Kentucky, in Florida, in Tennessee, both for the House and the Senate. And overall, we're seeing a trend. Democrats who tend to call for more money, more treatment, expanding Medicaid, restoring the provisions in the ACA, whereas Republicans are more likely to call for stricter enforcement, more arrests, going after the dealers, and sort of a more of a law and order approach, saying that you can't just throw money at the problem to fix it.
And are people responding to the messages in that district, in the Binghamton, New York area? Are they looking at candidates and saying, I like this approach better, I'm going to vote based on this issue?
Yeah, we, you know, we spoke to one voter who said that she really did think the Democrat had a better approach, and that she was, after having voted for the Republican, more likely to vote for the Democrat. And nationally, Democrats think that the issue plays better for them, that people know that you can't treat addicts for free, that you can't run detox facilities without money, and that their arguments for more health care and more funding are more likely to resonate with the voters.
And is this affecting a lot of different kinds of districts, or are there themes as far as the political makeup or economic makeup of the places that are really seeing opioids as an important issue that they want to hear from their candidates on?
You know, we're seeing it in the most hard-hit areas. Some of those areas tend to trend the part of the country we refer to as the Rust Belt. We're seeing it in parts of Pennsylvania, in upstate New York. But there's also in other regions like Florida, a district on the coast currently represented by Vern Buchanan that has been very hard hit. The Senate race there between the incumbent Bill Nelson and the governor Rick Scott. Indiana, where there's a competitive Senate race, and regions of the state that have been really hard hit. The opioid epidemic doesn't know an individual economic group or geographic group. It's really hitting across the country and across classes. And for that reason, it has the ability to touch voters in any of the nation's 435 congressional districts.
Ginger, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, Washington correspondent for Reuters. She was with us for our weekly look at national politics. Now, if you watch any TV shows or movies that have a dramatic hospital scene, you see a lot of details at play. Everything from what treatments are given to equipment to how actors portray suffering from an illness or injury. But do filmmakers get the details right? Our next guest is there to help out. Dr. Jonathan Kohler is a pediatric surgeon at UW Health. He also consults on TV shows and movies to ensure medical accuracy. Dr. Kohler, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, when you were watching TV and movies as a doctor, what kind of things were you seeing when it came to how your profession was portrayed?
Well, you know, I trained in Seattle at the University of Washington, which is ostensibly the Grey's Anatomy program. I remember looking around, that was sort of right around the time that Grey's Anatomy was, you know, the number one TV show, and looking around and saying that this is not my life. You know, they're outside the hospital in daylight, and there's a lot more canoodling going on than I was seeing in our hospital. But more importantly, you know, that I felt like TV could be doing a better job to show people what it meant to go to the hospital.
So what kind of things did you see them getting wrong when it came to that, the medical stuff and the procedural stuff?
Yeah, so my far and away least favorite thing to see is, and you see it all the time if you start looking on television, is, you know, a young, pretty actor has a cardiac arrest, and about 20 minutes later, they're sitting up in bed with a little, what we call nasal cannula. It's a little like oxygen tube that goes in the nose, and they're talking and they're cheery and they're happy, and I think that sort of thing sets really bad expectations for patients about what happens if, you know, someone in their own family is critically ill and goes to the hospital, and then they go in and they see, oh, they're on a ventilator, they're kind of puffy, they have IV bags surrounding them, they're not able to communicate. And I think that sort of expectation is where television can be really helpful and where it can also be potentially harmful, just making sure that people have valid expectations about what it's going to look like if they themselves have to go to the hospital.
So how did you get involved in working on TV shows and movies?
Well, I started, I had from a very early age, I was fascinated by theater. I did a lot of theater growing up. And then when I got to medical school, it became increasingly clear that it's going to be hard to do things that depended on being in the same place every night for a set period of time. So I started experimenting more with film and really found it to be really satisfying to produce on my own. But then, obviously, you know, in medicine, it's hard to even find time to do that sort of thing. So I got really interested in just being part of the storytelling and the way that, that films get made. And I got a master's degree in health communication while I was doing some research work in Boston. And through that program, got put in touch with a group at the University of Southern California that was doing consults for film and TV writers. And then that was sort of one-off questions, you know, how many lungs does a person have type thing. So sort of a human Google search. But then through that, ended up becoming connected with a writer who was developing a pilot. And, you know, at that point it was a one-sentence pitch, and we built it out into a script that then got shot in Toronto. And it ended up not getting filmed, but that writer became my son's godfather, and I met 200 people who dispersed to other shows. And then I was sort of in... I was on a list.
And so when you are brought in, could you come in at any stage from pilot to, or writing that initial script to actually you're on set as they're filming?
Yeah, I do everything. So a lot of what I do is via email, helping a lot around pilot season, and then a lot with sort of individual episodes. So, you know, a show that is not necessarily a medical show has a medical plot line, and they just need to sort of some help getting it realistic. We do that, and it's usually you can do it with a phone call and some emails back and forth. And then if, you know, we're shooting a full-on medical scene, oftentimes I'll go to the set and be on set and sort of make sure that all the visual details are correct, and then I can help the actors understand how to portray illness and how to portray being a doctor.
Is there ever a battle between, you know, the desire to make this dramatic or make sure we have a good line of sight to our attractive acting person versus the medical reality?
All the time. And I think that one of the things that we do particularly well is that I think, you know, I came up in narrative. I came up in drama and in film, and have always really appreciated that. And so I understand what writers want to do. And I understand the constraints that they're facing. And so, you know, if they come back to me and say, like, there's just no way that we can portray this disease taking 3 weeks, like it has to happen over 3 days, like usually we can figure out a way to make that realistic. So if they come to me and say, you know, I say, like, maybe we just need a different disease, something that accomplishes what you want to do, but it happens over 3 days instead of 3 weeks. And we find compromises that way. But, you know, there are definitely times when I'll sort of draw a line and say, look, this what you want to do is just not realistic. And in my experience, you know, if someone's gone through the trouble of hiring you to come there and tell them what it is and is not realistic, then they listen and you just come up with something better.
Is there a scene that you've been involved in that you feel particularly proud of, that this really told the story in a good way and told people what the reality was like in a medical setting?
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of pilots that I've done that I feel like it's just tragic that they never made it to air because they were so cool. Recently I did this movie with up in Toronto called A Family Man, and I was really proud of that film. I got involved sort of in the late script stage when they were trying to think of a way to have they basically came and said they have a kid that they need to have some sort of cancer and needs to progress, and then they need sort of a revolutionary therapy for it, and then that therapy needs to fail, and there needs to be a really tense moment trying to figure out, well, is this kid going to live or die, and then ideally we want to get him out of it at the end. And there was a new therapy kind of just reported at that time called CAR T-cell therapy, which is basically where you take T-cells, immune cells from a patient, take them out of the patient, transform them to attack a cancer, and then re-inject them back in. And at that point, it was, you know, two case reports, and we wrote the script around that. I helped the writer, Bill Dubuque, do that. And then we told the story of this kid getting this revolutionary therapy, and around the time that the film actually came out earlier this summer, that therapy got approved and is now looking like it's going to be an incredible therapy for leukemia and lymphoma, which is really cool to sort of have anticipated
Wow.
a big new development in cancer therapy, and it was really satisfying to be on set for that. I was there for 2 weeks, you know, just standing next to the director, this guy Mark Williams, for 2 weeks, just sort of tweaking every medical scene. And we tried to tell a bunch of medical stories for the medical people. So if you look at the monitors in that movie, you'll see that we're really telling a story with the vital signs of the patient. We can sort of give you a hint that trouble's coming, and then we also have all these IV poles and IV pumps around him, and you can see as he gets sicker, there's more and more, and then as he gets better, fewer and fewer of them around him. And it's fun to sort of tell little stories on the inside of the story with tricks like that.
As we wrap up, Dr. Kohler, I'm tempted to ask about, you know, something that gets it really wrong so I can snark about it, but I'll go the other way. Is there a show or movie that you weren't involved in that you watch and say, yeah, they really do a good job?
You know, I think that season one of Scrubs, the Christmas episode, gets medicine as right as anything I've ever seen. And I think that show is hugely influential among doctors. I think we all recognize that it captures, with comedy and with sort of outlandish situations, the reality of what it means to be a doctor better than most any other show I've ever seen. I mean, the other one, I think, is MASH. You know, I mean, like, that's an untouchable legend in medical TV that I think we'll never see anything that good again.
Dr. Kohler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure.
Dr. Jonathan Kohler is a pediatric surgeon at UW Health. He also consults on TV shows and movies to make sure they get the medical details right. If you read through the letters to the editor section of your local newspaper, you'll find a variety of opinions expressed, but what you'll also find is a lot of men. The same thing seems to happen in a lot of online comment forums, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman, have you ever written a letter to the editor? Do you participate in online comments online? Online twice there. And do you see more men than women writing in, calling in, and participating in online forums? Call in at 800-642-1234. Caroline Kitchener is an associate editor at The Atlantic and author of Postgrad, 5 Women in Their First Year Out of College. Her recent piece for The Atlantic is Why Do So Few Women Write Letters to the Editor? Caroline, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, what got you started thinking about this, Caroline?
Well, so yeah, I work here at The Atlantic, and I work specifically for the Masthead, our membership program, and so we're constantly doing these discussion forums. We've got a Facebook group, and we started noticing that almost all of the people who were posting were men, just overwhelmingly men. And so I wanted to look into it a little more. I went and I talked to the editor who oversees our letters to the editor section, and she said, yes, we're seeing exactly the same thing. She said, responding to one question, she was pretty sure there were more men named Michael than all women who had responded. So I think the two of us together then said, okay, well, what's going on here? Let's figure this out. Why are women so much less likely to contribute to these kinds of conversations?
And you reached out to several newspapers to see if it was just you or if this was the norm there, too. What did you find out?
I did, yeah. I reached out to a bunch of different – I wanted a bunch of different types of papers. So Kansas City Star, Chicago Tribune, Toronto Star. And I reached out to maybe, I don't know, a dozen papers. And all of them, everybody who got back to me saying, you know, we don't keep the specific numbers on this, but I do know from doing this for years that our letters are overwhelmingly male. And that's something that, you know, the New York Times has written about too, and nobody really seemed to know why.
And I'll say, as a call-in talk show host, we don't keep numbers for that. But yeah, subjectively, overwhelmingly, or substantially more men than women will call in, especially on political topics. So your next step, Caroline, is to try to figure out why. You talked to some experts on gender and communication, that sort of thing. What is out there? What do people think?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing that we hear, that I heard again and again, was really depressing, and it was that women are just less likely to think that they are experts in a topic. It takes more for a woman to, generally, obviously, to feel that, you know, I know enough about this to say it to the world. And then also, you know, other people are going to care what I have to say. Men are a lot more likely to think those things. and feeling confident as a sort of expert is kind of a prerequisite to writing a letter to the editor.
There's two ways to think about that, I guess. One is it would be good if more people participated, so it would be great if women were more prone to speak up. The other answer, and you got some of these responses, is do we really want people who don't know what they're talking about putting their views out there? Maybe men should dial it back to the level that women are at, and then only the people with expertise will be writing these letters, making these comments. What kind of things did you hear about that?
Yeah, so one of my favorite conversations that I had going into this was somebody who had, who had analyzed all of the letters that went into a, local paper, the Greensboro News and Record in North Carolina, and he found that, the letters were, again, overwhelmingly male, but 90% of them did not even address any article published by the paper. He said that they were just overwhelmingly extremely unfocused. They didn't really convey any kind of expertise. So what he said to me, and this was probably my favorite quote from the article, the confidence that men have is not particularly warranted, so maybe they should just scale back. I don't know what the solution is. I mean, I think it's probably a bit of both. We certainly for the Atlantic would love to see more women writing to us.
Caroline Kitchener is with us from the Atlantic, asking the question: why do so few women write letters to the editor? And add into that, make comments on online news articles. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever written a letter to the editor? Why do you think men are more prone to do it than women? Especially like to hear from women if you do or don't comment on news articles. If you do or don't write into newspapers, why? Why not? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Caroline, one thing that you did find is that women are prone to participate in these news articles by sharing them on places like Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really interesting finding. On platforms where women know or are more likely to know the people that they are sending this information to, women are more likely to express opinions in those forums. So whereas, the letters to the editor, you have no idea who's reading that paper. You have no control over your audience. You post an argument on your Facebook page, all of those people are people, well, hypothetically, that you know. What I heard was that women are just more comfortable expressing their opinions when they, and I think everyone is, if they feel confident that the people that they're reaching out to actually care what they have to say, and they're more likely to believe that people care what you have to say if you know them.
One other hypothesis out there is that women might fear a bigger backlash, maybe a more personal, a more vitriolic backlash than a man might.
Yeah, absolutely. Trolling is real, and trolling is, I think, generally just a lot harsher on women. I mean, I've experienced that as a female journalist, and many of my colleagues, my female colleagues, have experienced the same thing.
Again, we can take callers at 800-642-1234. Got a few people queuing up on the line there. Why does this matter? Is this an important forum where we should care, Caroline, how people are represented?
I think it absolutely is an important forum. I mean, it is, it's probably dying out. The people who write letters to the editor, I don't know the numbers on this, but I'm sure that they skew older. But still, it is. It represents something important, I think. This is one of the country's most essential modes of political engagement. It's one of the most direct ways that you can get your opinion out there to a large group. I think it is really important.
I want to bring on a caller now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think that people should exercise their right to their opinion, putting it out there, especially in the letter to the editor. It's only an opinion. There's no harm. You're not you're not depriving anyone of their view. You're just expressing your views.
And do you write letters to the editor yourself, Barbara?
Oh, yes, I do.
Frequently, I'm guessing, from your reaction?
Quite often I do. I do get published.
Barbara,
thank you. Great to hear.
You're saying how you started, Barbara. Go ahead.
Oh, I started with an article. It was at the Iowa State University Alumni Magazine, and they were lauding the cult and an alumni, and I brought up other issues, that the problem was guns, and that was the first time I was published, and I got kind of hooked.
Barbara, thank you so much for sharing that. And Caroline, yeah, this could be a thing where if people try it for the first time, as Barbara did, they might get hooked.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, feeling like people care about what you have to say, that's a great feeling.
Thanks a lot for that call, Barbara. We'll go next to Simon in Viroqua. Simon, hi.
Hey, so I'm a guy who hasn't read the Atlantic article, so I may be an uninformed opinionator here. But I just wanted to share, there's a group called Op-Ed Project out of New York that recognizes a similar pattern with op-eds, which are a front door forum for thought leaders in our culture, and also diagnose the problem as women just legitimately have less time because of the many caregiving shifts and other shifts that they work in our culture. So I thought it was an important contribution to the conversation here. I don't know if you or the writer have come across the Op-Ed Project, but they're pretty cool.
Simon, thanks a lot for that call. And Caroline, in the responses to your article that you shared on The Atlantic, that's something that some people brought up, the time issue that women may face.
Yes, absolutely. I had a lot of women just say, hey, I'm too busy. I don't have time for this. You know, men might be sitting around twiddling their thumbs and wondering what they can write to the letter, what letter to the editor they can write every week, but I'm not. I've got a lot to do. And yeah, I hear you.
Caroline, in our last minute and a half or so, we keep hearing that this might be politically the year of the woman, supposedly. A lot of women candidates running and winning primaries, we're finding out from yesterday. Do you think that this could maybe be accompanied by more letter to the editor writing and that kind of participation by women?
Oh, man, I really hope so. I think that would make sense. You know, when female candidates are probably more likely to, you know, inspire really strong feelings in women and galvanize them to put their opinions out there.
And Caroline, did a lot of women write letters to the editor at The Atlantic in response to this piece?
Yes, and that was the best part. I did not really expect this article to. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't, you know, pegged to anything particularly time sensitive. You know, it really got a lot of attention from readers, and we had it was just so heartening to see my inbox just fill up with letters from women, you know, telling me, you know, why they write letters to the editor, why they don't, and why they want this to change.
Caroline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. This was fun.
That was Caroline Kitchener, associate editor at The Atlantic. We talked about her recent piece there titled, Why Do So Few Women Write Letters to the Editor? Well, you can write us a letter, and if we find some time, we could share it. You can always email us about what you hear, ideas@WPR.org, with your responses and your maybe ideas for future conversations. Yesterday, I asked you to share some of your unusual beverage combinations after I had an accidental run-in with espresso mixed with root beer. Here are some of your favorites, for better or worse. Claire says, a combination drink since I was a child was orange juice and cranberry juice. Smiley face. That doesn't sound too bad. I mean, when you're mixing fruit juices, yeah, it's hard to go too wrong. David says, hi, I mix cranberry juice, okay, so far, with milk. It thickens and is delicious. It curdles the milk a little if you let it sit. Just stir, and it's rich and thick again. We're making some big sales at the control board here. Randy says, I once had Dairy Queen workers in a class reading The Jungle. We discussed the worst blizzards. That's the ice cream thing at Dairy Queen. The worst blizzards possible. Winners, tripe blizzard, Limburger and Braunschweiger Blizzard, and winner Fish Fry Blizzard with all the sides. I don't think anybody ever put those to the test. Nobody made those. Gary had a story for us. He grew up in northern Wisconsin where people would drink, you know, for alcohol, beer, brandy, maybe gin, vodka. He says, early in my career, I was assigned to southern Mississippi. Somebody gave me Jim Beam bourbon at Christmas. I never tasted bourbon before. I thought it was awful. My budget was tight. I was going to find a way to enjoy it. I settled on bourbon and orange juice. To this day, I often have bourbon and orange juice on the plane. Almost always get a strange look or question about it. There are bourbon drinks out there that end up with some orange in them. I'm going to allow that, Gary. Keep sharing your favorite unusual drinks, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. This is the Ideas Network.